terms of your self-assessment on the revenue and the impairment ones. Thank you. So we have now given the leaders of those discussion groups an hour to cogitate in terms of how they are going to respond to their group's diverse views on the questions. So, Charles, I'm not quite sure how you want to operate this, and you were the leader of one of the groups. So we have effectively just under an hour, but I think we can probably go for an hour, which implies, given that we have five groups, effectively 10 minutes. Well, I'd like some time perhaps just to sum up at the end to see if it's at all possible to try to do that. So perhaps slightly less than 10 minutes each from each group to present the answers to the questions or however you see fit to do it. And I'm actually going to start, sorry, Charles, with you as the first one.
Thank you, Joanna.
Chair's prerogative.
I hope the Wallabies can do something to the All Blacks. Payback. Our group was a small but select group of investors. And in terms of the first question, started with an observation that in reality there's a continuous spectrum between principles and rules. So, typically guidance is sought when people are looking for clarity, presumably to achieve comparability or consistency, but guidance in fact becomes a form of a rule. So therefore the view is expressed that less guidance is better than more guidance if we are truly being consistent with a principles-based accounting framework. And ultimately there was a lovely line that when it comes to judgment, there's no substitute for common sense. The more prescriptive, the more rules-based approach that we adopt, the more it drives everyone to a sort of a one-size-fits-all and you lose some of the nuances. Whilst we were a consistent group in terms of investors, there were differences that did reflect geography and culture. And there was a recognition that there are some geographies and cultures and sometimes it's embedded in a culture. In other occasions, it may be a reflection of where that particular geography is in terms of their evolution towards full adoption of IFRS. There is naturally a greater demand for guidance than in some other jurisdictions. We recognise that it's not possible to really differentiate between jurisdictional locations. So it is, in that sense, an overall approach that has to meet the needs of everyone. And the way in which we dealt with that conundrum is that we need a framework that will actually guide preparers. And it then begged the question, well, who should provide the guide? Obviously, IFRIC has a role when the diversity of outcomes or the judgments are just too wide to accept. We've just had a session that deals with guidance that can be authoritative or non-authoritative, educative. And there's also the observation made, although not necessarily consensus agreement, that in those jurisdictions that are early in the evolution of implementing IFRS, that to the extent that they need help in terms of the process by which judgment can be applied, and we tended to focus somewhat on the impairment of assets or fair value of assets as a good illustration of an area where judgment is required, it may be possible for particularly the major audit firms who would have experience across a wide range of jurisdictions to indicate the sort of criteria, the sort of factors, the sort of assumptions that would need to be made. We certainly had a strong view that the disclosure of assumptions that underpin judgments needs to be quite fulsome. So in that sense, it comes back to a point that, I think Anne made before we broke to our groups, that ultimately judgment is about a process more than anything else. And in that sense, we had a bit of a debate about what are the advantages of an ex-ante approach or process, i.e. where there's guidance pre-judgment or pre the decision, versus an ex-post framework where it's post the decision, but there's a fulsome explanation of the basis on which that judgment was formed. And I think it's fair to say that balanced, the group reflecting the user community was reasonably satisfied with the ex-post approach. And indeed, in some jurisdictions, it's almost mandatory within the MD&A for those critical assumptions that underpin judgments to actually be disclosed in the accounts anyway. We also acknowledge that different users will have a different approach. Some will focus on almost line by line explanation of the key financials, which they then plug into their detailed models. At the other end of the spectrum are those people who are more focused on understanding the company's strategy and competitive landscape, and highlights the difference between quantitative and qualitative approaches. And obviously there's a continuous spectrum between both of those as well. In terms of the question two, the role of the ISB in exercising judgment, there's a very strong consensus here that we should avoid bright lines and also anti-abuse provisions, recognising that unfortunately there's always a minority that will take advantage of loopholes, and it's the response to trying to deal with that minority that leads to more prescriptive approaches such as anti-abuse provisions and bright lines. The weakness with bright lines is that it is very much a one-size-fits-all approach and may not necessarily be an accurate reflection of the position that should be disclosed, and the preparers or the companies in the best position to do that. So that requires some discretion. With the anti-abuse provisions, the feeling was that those people that want to abuse the system or take advantage of loopholes still will find ways to get around it and clever gaming and structuring. So there was a very strong consensus on this particular question that the ISB should avoid bright lines and anti-abuse provisions. And probably the phrase that comes to mind is that we shouldn't let the perfect get in the way of the good, recognising that we're not all perfect and we're not all good. With regard to the last question, we spent a little bit of time trying to agree on what we meant by all financial reporting stakeholders. We concluded that the universe that we would consider were the primary users of financial reporting, namely the investment community, the investor community, and in that regard, the sort of discussion that we had in considering question one really addressed most of the concerns there, recognising that the form of financial reporting and financial accounting embedded in IFRS will meet most of the needs of those primary users, and they will seek through other mechanisms additional information that they may want through in a meeting with company management and the like. So I think that's sort of a reasonable summary of where we got to, but I invite any of my colleagues to add anything or amend anything that they don't agree with in terms of my summary.
Okay, I'm going to jump around. Jake, would you like to report back on your group, which was the auditors group?
Thank you. As I walked back in 5 minutes early, one of my group said that must be because we've got all the answers. But having reread my notes, I just want to dispel that idea before I start. We started really with the question, well, why are we here and why are we here now, thinking about these particular questions? Is there a real demand to be thinking about where the balance between judgment and rules is, and if so, why is that now? We felt that, therefore, we should reaffirm to the board that bandwidth in judgment is okay. We expect there to be judgment. We are happy with the idea that there's judgment. And we felt perhaps one of the reasons we might be here is the thirst for ever more guidance. For example, the revenue implementation group, more and more people asking for more and more detail. But we very much had the conclusion that judgment is right, that there is a need for that. So we felt it would be useful, therefore, to try and operationalise the question and try and provide something useful back to the board. What could we say to the board for them to build upon? Firstly, diversity isn't an issue, provided that disclosure is sufficient, disclosure around what the judgments are. And in thinking about that, there are a number of areas where judgment is likely to play a part. For instance, determining how to apply a high-level principle to a particular set of facts and circumstances. That's one type of judgment. Forming a judgment around a number where there is estimation uncertainty. That's another form of judgment that's applied by preparers. And making a judgment about whether a disclosure or whether the application of a standard is material is another area where we expect there to be judgment. Overall, we felt principles are important. I4S is global, and without that fundamental idea that we are aiming at principles, you're going to get into a lot of entity-specific rules at the end of the day, and you'll end up with a plethora of rules, and that's not where we would ideally like to be. We then gave some thought to in what areas do we think judgment may give rise to rules or give way to rules. There was a feeling that anti-abuse provisions should not be necessary, provided that the principles in the standard are well articulated. So perhaps it is when those principles are not as well articulated as they might be, that it becomes necessary to introduce rules to ensure that there isn't abuse of those principles. We felt that where there was either a culture of either a lack of transparency or a history of rules, there might be a natural tendency for those jurisdictions, those people, to ask for more guidance. And so there must therefore be a need for the ISB to ensure that there's sufficient education of all stakeholders of the need for properly for the use of proper judgment. At that point, we came back to reiterate something or re-emphasise something that was discussed this morning, which was the need for a robust conceptual framework and the need for the board to take its time in making decisions over potentially contentious areas, as the conceptual framework is often very useful in helping to articulate how a principle within a standard should be applied. So we would just encourage the ISB to take their time with that. We spent a little bit of time about thinking about who else might be making rules. Was it us, the auditors in the room? We quickly moved on from that, as we clearly don't make rules. And also the regulators, and we spent a bit of time wondering about whether actually there was a shift over time from a time when auditors, in signing the audit opinion, had to be the people that were ultimately enforcing the standards and therefore making the final judgment about whether a standard had been applied appropriately or not, and whether there was a shift in time from the auditors to the regulators. And again, we came back to there being a need for the ISB to ensure that there's dialogue and to encourage consistency around the world amongst these groups to make it clear what role they should be playing in the application of IFRS. We did spend a little bit of time wondering why there might be a demand for more and more in the way of rules. I come back to the point that Hans, I think you made very early on, which was there's 106 different jurisdictions now There's different languages, there's different cultures, there's different behaviours. All of those may have a different desire for a different balance between judgments and rules. There was a feeling that sometimes the guidance in the standards, the implementation guidance, are perhaps a little bit too easy, and we questioned whether they adequately demonstrated the role that judgment has to play in applying the accounting standards. And there was a feeling that examples do not always take into account the different cultural backgrounds that there are, the different languages that people are struggling to read these standards in, and a feeling that the standards are therefore not always clear-cut, sometimes despite the belief of IFRIC and other interpretational bodies. We then spent a little bit of time wondering about what other stakeholders might say, and we felt that often preparers and auditors have all the information they need to make the judgments and are therefore generally quite comfortable in doing so. The real challenge comes around other stakeholders who are trying to digest a much more condensed version of those judgments, and it came back to the point we felt that disclosure therefore becomes vital to adequately portray the judgments that have been taken. And that's my best effort to give you the answers and portray the views of all of the people in the room. Thank you.
Any other comments from anyone else in the auditors group? Okay, I'm going to give the regulators a chance to respond. Marcus.
Okay, thank you very much. So let's start with question one. Where we see a relationship between principles, basis for conclusion, guidance, and examples. And those four items, we build a picture. We start with the principles. We got the feeling that the principles are not always as clear as they should be. And that's why you then go to the examples, to guidance, and to the basis for conclusions. Let me talk about examples. If you provide examples, people, especially preparers, would try to structure around these examples or get the treatment within the examples, which makes it easy for them and the auditors. And the next thing with examples is that you need enough examples and sophisticated enough examples. Why do we need the basis for conclusion? The basis for conclusion provides insight into the thought process of the ISB, and not only in the thought process, but also in the objective which the board tried to achieve by the principle. Having said this, the basis for conclusion provides for legal issues because in some jurisdiction it is not binding. So therefore the result was that there should be a process around the principles where the objective of the board becomes clear. We also had a good example in mind where it seems to work, that was IFRS 10. Where the principles are elaborated. So let me switch over to the second question. What should be the ISB's role in the exercise of judgment? So this goes back to what I already said, but also we see that around the judgment there are auditing standards, which the ISB is not responsible, but the IAASB. Also you have an new audit report, which should provide in the future more details. Then you have the legal environment around, and of course you have IFRIC decisions, which are very helpful in two ways. One way is that sometimes a treatment is rejected, and in other cases a project will be initiated. Also, we deem it important that the ISB has a clear communication to the public and influences behavior via education. So, the sub-question on the bright lines versus anti-abuse, we were not in favor of bright lines, but we see a need for anti-abuse guidance to get from not so good judgment to good judgment. And the need for this anti-abuse guidance is imminent from what I said in to question one. Let me talk about the third question. So we were talking about the different stakeholders, about auditors, preparers, and our role as regulators. We already heard it from Jake that there is the impression that the regulators now are responsible for corrective action, and if you look to when judgment is misused, we came to the conclusion that in most cases this is when an entity is in financial distress, and then judgment could be misused, and preparers and feel the need that they do not reflect properly sometimes the treatment and misuse the judgment, and auditors are not as skeptical as we wish they would be, and therefore the regulators come in for the corrective action. One observation we made was that we are not the opinion that in different jurisdictions you have different judgments, not necessarily. So basically that's my summary of what we discussed, and I'm happy if somebody likes to add from the group.
Thank you, Marcus. Stephanie, would you like to let us know where the standard set has got to?
Absolutely. Thank you, Joanna. I'll just make some general comments that I think we came mostly to agreement on and then get to the specific questions. So the standard setters group, I think there was a very strong message generally about support for principle-based standards as an international standard setter. That's not to say that everybody in the group liked that. There were definitely some who liked rules, but stepping back as an international standard setter, excuse me, they... I think developing principle-based standards was acknowledged to be the only way to go. However, also acknowledging that principles alone, that something that Hugh had said in his slides, that principles alone doesn't really stand up, that you do need to have some guidance. Now, interestingly enough, contrary to something Charles said, we didn't necessarily agree that guidance equals rules. I think your group, Charles, said that guidance in effect become rules. We actually specifically said guidance does not necessarily equal rules. So I guess on the spectrum, it becomes the nature of the guidance. And we spent some time talking about what types of guidance might be helpful and sort of in terms of advice to the board. There was certainly a sense, and somebody else mentioned this, I think, Marcus, about if there was more fulsome explanations of the board's positions and how they were developed, how the issues had been considered, that in itself was a type of guidance that would have high value, be very helpful. Even things that there could be some improvements in terms of the use of terms being used more consistently, and that those types of things that even as in effect guidance would provide a type of guidance for people. A couple of other overall comments. I think you, Charles, the notion of common sense. We said overall there is still this true and fair override that I think that we thought was quite important. And consistent with, I think, what Jake reported on the auditors group, we talked about the role of the conceptual framework and in terms of judgment, and that the fact that there's a need for a strong conceptual framework, that will help users understand standards better, and going to that point of being sure to get it right and take the time to do it. So that was some of our overall comments. In terms of the specific questions, in the first question, we actually spent some time talking first about currently, is there a right balance between principles and detailed guidance? And we had a lot of discussion about how it depends, that there's generally a sense that some of the standards are better than others in terms of some being more principles-based and some being less principles-based or having more rules in them. And there was also this, it depends, based on the situation and the jurisdiction that you're in and whether you, how you would answer that question. Certainly there were some jurisdictions, they felt there was far more pressure from regulators for rules and so on. So there was definitely differing opinions, and the overall answer to in currently is the balance right still came back to it depends. And a notion that it would be more helpful if there would more consistencies between the standards in that regard without really some solid solutions. That kind of goes back to, though, the first point of still being very supportive of principle-based standards as an international standard setter. In terms of the second question, we kind of broke that into two. So the first part, what should be the IASB's role in the exercise of judgment, we actually got into a discussion here about the IASB's role in terms of education and what it could do, provide in terms of training on applying professional judgment and how important that could be, particularly in certain jurisdictions. So we certainly, I think there was a more or less a consensus in the group that that could have some real value, this notion of conceptual teaching. In terms of the other question, should the IASB avoid bright lines and anti-abuse provisions, I'm interested that our answer to this wasn't as so sure as a couple of the others have reported. I think generally we felt in an ideal world, sure, it would be nice if to avoid all of that. So maybe the word avoid, yes, I think we could probably support the notion that in an ideal world, you would want to avoid those things. But I think as standard setters, we kind of came back to say we found that to be an impossible situation as standard setters, and that we felt that there were probably just times that you had to do this. We didn't necessarily have a strong, in terms of bright lines, we actually saw some value in them at times, particularly if they were married with rebuttable presumptions, that they could have some value. Again, maybe not what you want every day and in every standard, but that we thought that there could be a role for those. So that's, I think, a slightly different message than I heard from some of the others. And the anti-abuse, we had the same sort of discussion. This wasn't really, I would say, a full consensus, but that sometimes you just end up in a situation where you want to have to avoid something. And it may go contra a little bit to the notion of principle-based standards, but being pragmatic, yes, let's avoid it, but sometimes it just has to happen. In terms of question three, we approach this from looking at the objectives of all financial reporting stakeholders and saying, could we really satisfy them all, and came to the conclusion, looking at it from that perspective, we really couldn't, that the standards are written with primary user of investors, and that you have to stay focused on that, and that all of the other users obviously are important and will result in pressures being put on you in terms of as you develop the standards, and that you have to pay attention to. But there was a general sense of it just is almost impossible to make it compatible with the needs, with the objectives of all financial reporting stakeholders. That was definitely our sense. The last question about good disclosure, compensate for diversity in the practice. We came around to not really, meaning it depends on the source of the diversity. And we also said that disclosure isn't really a tool. We didn't see disclosure as a tool or the tool for solving that diversity. We certainly put an emphasis should be on the need for making better judgments, and that you can't really rely on disclosures for that. So yes, you'd need to use disclosures when you're talking about the judgments you make, but we didn't see that as the answer in terms of addressing the diversity, and there's a bit of an acceptance that some diversity will naturally end up existing. And I think that's what my notes reflected, but if anybody else from my group would like to add, I'm sure there's more we could say.
Finally, Ernesto, for the preparers. Oh, and he's going to stand up.
Okay. Well, I mean, for the preparers, there was a high degree of consensus. There was some limited references to auditors, so maybe next time it would be nice if they could be around. I mean, clearly, more than looking at the balance, if there's too much detailed guidance at the moment, what we focus was on detailed guidance becoming rules de facto, right? We believe that if a principle needs clarification, it's fine, but in general, the ISB should stay away from being too specific. Auditors, in general, bring the risk of qualifying accounts if you, deviate from the rule but fulfill the principle if you end in this debate. Also, I mean, one of the risks that were mentioned is that convergence with US GAAP is great, but it also brings the risks of more rules. And discussing with, for the future, also with auditors, we are discussing methodology sometimes. And this could end up being rules. And the example that was discussed is probably with credit deterioration of a counterparty, right? I mean, it's the concept. And maybe the auditor technical department comes with a specific issue of just the credit spread moving, and you have a different way of measuring that with credit rating or whatever. And basically to be aware that there's always that that tension, and we should basically be able to communicate our methodology. I'll then get into the question of disclosure, if that helps with diversity is the last one, but basically it fits with everything we were discussing. I mean, disclosure of estimates, assumptions, and methodology should help to clarify, and it's really what we find when we meet investors. I mean, investors want to know how we are building the accounts and how the prospects of the business go forward, right? And that the disclosure of estimates and assumptions and methodology serves them in our view. In the end, what makes economic sense is what convinces investors, right? In terms of the bright lines or anti-abuse provisions, we think it should be the auditors raising any material issues in the accounts. We don't believe in putting bright lines or anti-abuse provisions. In terms of the use of judgment. Be made compatible with the objectives of all financial reporting stakeholders. Yes, we believe as long as information, material judgment is provided, the economic substance will be reflected, and therefore comparability that is valued and maybe might not be achieved, but with this kind of disclosure, we should be in a fine situation. And then we had one question also regarding the use of judgment. We're wondering if ASAF is getting the same kind of questions. We're just wondering that.
Good on you to finish with the question. Yeah, maybe just answer that one quickly, Ian.
We haven't taken this broad philosophical question to ASAF.
Same dissimilar discussion probably in our advisory group are comprised of preparers and investors, and they are following actually the council discussion today, and then they were going to from that devise topics that will be focused on. Okay.
Well, I think that feedback has been certainly illuminating for me, and trying to think the feedback that we can provide to the board as a result of that, and Hugh is nodding, so he obviously thought it was illuminating too. What I will now try to do is to see if I can sum up what I think I have heard from the different groups in terms of the general theme, and get Hugh or Charles or others to agree or add to that. I think it is very clear that the whole group is supportive of principles-based standards. So that is really, really good that we endorse the philosophy behind what the ISB is trying to do, and I emphasise the word trying at the moment, and an acknowledgement that judgment, therefore, is a key part of financial statements. I think one clear message to me that came through is that that some of the difficulty that we have currently is that the principles are not necessarily articulated as well as they might be, or consistently across standards, and that the comments came through to me that if principles are articulated properly, then we don't quite possibly need that much more guidance. And certainly, I think it was, and I can't remember which group was talking about, yes, we need, perhaps we need more guidance, but it's not more rules. And I heard there again, it's actually guidance to help to understand what the principle means, if you like, and maybe again, it's that if we can clearly articulate the principles. So maybe the message and you know, obviously we can't rewrite all the standards at once, but in terms of just making really sure that the principles are articulated very clearly seems to me to be a key message coming through. Education, interestingly, I think came through from a lot of the groups in terms of is that a role that the ISB can or should play rather than, and I know we've talked about that and it is a key passion of various people in the ISB around actually the education in this area as opposed to actually issuing more guidance is actually education and having it focused on the areas and the places, geographies and people that actually need it. Generally, I think other than the standard setters, which I thought is very interesting, that disclosure, people are very keen that disclosure of the judgments, on the basis that judgments are there, that disclosure is very, very important. And I don't think the standards were saying it wasn't important, it was just that it doesn't overcome, if you like, diversity, whereas I think I got from everybody else that the judgment and diversity is okay so long as it is there is full disclosure and that's what investors are effectively looking for. Interestingly, I think that the biggest diversity of report back was in relation to the Bright Line and the anti-abuse, and very interesting the different groups coming back with that, that there was there definitely wasn't consensus was what I got out of that. So I'm not quite sure where we take that one, but interesting that there are different views there and maybe we can just probe a little bit further as to how and why those are as they are. So those, I think, were the key bits that I've summed up from what everybody said in terms of more or less a consensus in terms of feedback for this council, if you like, to provide to the board. Does that make, and I'm looking at Hugh, are those the things that you picked up?
I thought that was an excellent summary, and I'd like to thank everybody for all the feedback. It was really, really very, very good. No, I think it was a very good summary. I think it is interesting, a number of people have said that it is important to articulate principles as clearly as possible. I think it is also true to say that, and one of the groups made this point, that, in fact, I think more than one group made this point, there will be a need for some additional guidance to put the flesh on the bone, so to speak. I just would make perhaps one other point in relation to education. We do have a small education team. It is small, but it does actually have high impact. And the approach is what we call a framework-based approach. So it is trying to relate it back to the conceptual framework and think about underlying economics, think about what the principles are, and then after having done all of that thinking, consider what the standards level requirements actually are. So we try to do as much as we can with the limited resource on education. I think it is a good point to make and something that we do bear in mind.
Charles, do you have any final comments on this one?
Joanne, I think your summary was excellent. To me, the big surprise was overall a lack of diversity in terms of differences between the different groups. When we thought about how to structure the breakouts, we did it deliberately to separate each of the groups, thinking that we would get quite divergent views, at least on some of the major questions. In fact, I think there's a high degree of similarity. It probably, to some extent, does mask the reality that even within a group there was some diversities, and obviously in presenting the summaries of the group, one's sort of trying to summarise that and not bring out all of the nuances. But all in all, I think it was a very encouraging discussion, particularly from the sort of feedback for the board, that strong commitment to principles-based, need for support, it's probably the way I describe it, and that support can take many different forms, horses for courses, I guess, depending on the need. And probably the one thing that didn't come out in your summary, which I think a couple of groups, certainly was very strong in our group, was that a lot of the demand or request or appetite for more support, guidance, whatever, does reflect cultural differences, and that's just a reality. And in thinking about the implementation by countries coming on board to IFRS, that's something that I think the board needs to take into account in terms of how best to support those groups. And clearly, I think in our previous session, there is clearly a lot of thinking going on in terms of those particular groups that might be formed to assist in a particular standard or could assist in a jurisdiction coming on board.
Thank you, Charles. Does anyone else in the group have any last comments that they would like to make in relation to the use of judgment?